take revenge because of, quote, progress in the way to lift sanctions, end quote. Zarif promised retaliation but did not elaborate. A spokesperson for Iran's foreign ministry said nuclear talks would resume on Wednesday. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 61 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, 50 degrees and overcast. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
The time now is 5 p.m. Stay tuned for Deadline NYC with Tom Robbins. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Here's some advice for you, friend. Don't press your luck. Lay off of me. Don't print that story.
What's that supposed to be? An order?
Listen to me! Print that story, you're a dead man.
It's not just me anymore. You'd have to stop every newspaper in the country now, and you're not big enough for that job. People like you have tried it before, with bullets, prison, censorship. But as long as even one newspaper will print the truth, you're finished.
What's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
Welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. I say, welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. Yeah. They got plenty of rats and roaches. Enough welfare for everyone. They got a whole lot of police cars with their lights all flashing red.
There's Leon Thomas on vocals, Johnny Hodges on alto sax, welcoming us to New York, or at least the New York of 1970. And before that, the unmistakable growl of Humphrey Bogart, portraying the idealistic newspaper editor in the 1952 film classic Deadline USA, telling the racketeer, there's no way, baby, to stop the presses. My name's Tom Robbins, and I borrowed that tough-sounding movie title for the name of this show, which I call Deadline NYC. The whole country is talking and listening and following the trial of a Minneapolis police officer facing charges in the murder of George Floyd last year. And now, just this weekend, comes the shooting death of another 20-year-old black man in a nearby suburb. Of all places, the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and its neighboring city, St. Paul, would seem like an unlikely place for America to finally confront the question as to whether police officers will be held criminally accountable for their actions. To talk about the Floyd case, the shooting this weekend of 20-year-old Daunte Wright, and the problems of local law enforcement generally in the Twin Cities, we're going to talk this evening to Ruben Rosario, a former newspaper columnist for the Pioneer Press in St. Paul. Ruben Rosario is a remarkable man. Let me tell you a little bit about him. I know him from the days when we worked together at the New York Daily News, where Ruben was one of the paper's leading reporters covering crime, the courts, and the streets. Ruben once famously hung out in a crack den in the 1980s to give news readers a sense of the effects and drastic impact of that deadly drug. He was in the courtroom when mobster John Gotti was finally brought to justice. But in 1991, Ruben, who's a native of San Juan, Puerto Rico, and who was raised in the Bronx in Manhattan, left New York to take a job at the Pioneer Press. And there he quickly established himself as the city's leading newspaper editor, reporter, and then columnist. How popular was he in his adopted city? Consider that Ruben Rosario won 8 first-place awards for column writing in the Minnesota Society of Professional Journalists Page 1 Awards, along with a basketful of other awards. Rubin left the press last year after 29 years at the paper, and he recently published a powerful collection of his work called, and the title has a nice familiar ring, Deadline Minnesota. Rubin still writes an occasional column for the paper, and he's weighed in a number of times on how the Floyd case is affecting the city. We'll talk to him about that and also about his life and career in the newspaper business. Rubin, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot, Tom. Good to hear you.
Okay. Keep your voice up real close so we can make sure we can hear you clearly. Let's
Sounds
start.
Good.
You got it? Let's start with current events. I mean, you know, you and I spoke, you know, late last week, and in the interim hours on Sunday, this 20-year-old man was killed by police in a traffic stop in the town of Brooklyn Center, and within hours there was tear gas being used against outraged protesters. Can you tell us about that incident or what you know about it, but more broadly about what's the relationship there between residents and the police force? Why is this location such a tense place for these incidents?
Well, we have to go a little bit to the recent past. In 2015, Jamar Clark was shot to death at close range during an encounter with two Minneapolis police officers. None of the police officers were charged. In 2016, as probably many of your listeners may have known about, Philando Castile was stopped by a St. Paul suburban police officer on a routine traffic stop, and apparently what we all saw was his girlfriend on Facebook Live watching as this man, a boyfriend, was shot seven times by a cop who feared that Philando Castile was going to pull out his gun, who apparently had a permit to carry and had told the officers they had it on him. In 2000, right after that, you had the Justine Damone case involving a Australian native living in Minneapolis who heard what she thought was an alleged rape taking place in the back alley and ran in her called the cops, ran in her pajamas to summon the squad car or track it down, and she ends up dead because one of the cops in the squad car got spooked and thought that his life was threatened. And that cop underwent trial, and he was convicted. Then we had George Floyd now, who is now undergoing the officer who is accused of taking his life, is now undergoing a trial, which apparently the world is watching. And then last night we had a young man, 20-year-old, by the name of Dante Wright, who was stopped for expires license tabs and ends up dead, being shot by a female police officer in a suburban city of Brooklyn Center. It's about 10 miles north of Minneapolis, who apparently, according to police chief at a press conference today, accidentally mistook her service revolver for the taser, which she was trying to tase this young man, and ended up shooting him dead.
Let me just ask you about that, Ruben, before. I mean, because I saw that report. Does that sound believable to you? Is a taser mounted on your belt right next to your gun? Can you reach for one and then mistakenly pick up the other?
The training and the protocol in the police departments now is that you have to have the taser at the opposite side of the body where your dominant hand and your service gun is. It can't be on the same side. So I don't know how this police officer involved in a routine, you know, expired license tab, mistakes her taser for her gun. And you can hear in the recording, because the police chief on publicly today showed the media the body camera that shows the shooting. And in the video, you can hear her saying, taser, 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 before she fires the fatal shot. You ever hear those things where you have some gruesome crime and you interview the town resident? The town resident says, this stuff never happens here. Well, yeah, it keeps happening. It's no surprise it's happening in Minneapolis, as it has happened in New York, We can go back in New York to the Eleanor Bumpus case, back in the Bronx, back in the 80s, when a grandmother was shot and shotgunned to death by a cop. Right. You know, who was, I think they had gone there to enforce an eviction, her eviction. These things have been happening. You know, I believe now the big difference, and it started with Rodney King, we now are seeing these things happen because people are taking photos, people are taking videos.
And in this case, we have the police own video of what went down.
Correct.
You know, I think for New Yorkers, and that's most of our listening audience, I think people would appreciate hearing from you who know the scene so well. Oh, how is it that the relationship between the local Black and Latino community in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and I guess even out in the suburbs, is so mm-hmm. tense that an officer can pull a loaded gun and shoot somebody? What is the relationship between the police and the local community? How would you describe it?
Well, it depends on which police. If you're talking about Minneapolis, ever since I got here back in the 1990s, there's been always a tense relation between communities of color and it's the police department. When I got here, one of the big stories, and this is back in 1991, was a couple of Minneapolis cops who found some intoxicated men, homeless men, I believe, of Native American descent. And instead of calling an ambulance, they just loaded the guys because they didn't want to mess up their back seat of the squad car. They loaded these guys in the trunk of the police car and drove them to the hospital that way. I mean, you know.
In the trunk of the car?
I was like, what? Then on the across the river, you got the cops in St. Paul, who have the reputation of being the kindler, gentler police force. There have been fatal shootings here, but in my case, in my experience, most of them have been justified. It's been either they have been shot at or the suspect has been armed with something. In Minneapolis, they've always had this problem, this tense situation. And the situation is the racial disparity here, it may be as pronounced, if not sharper, than in other places like New York or anywhere else. You have a African-American population in the Twin Cities metro area of 13%, yet most of the arrests are 63% of the arrests are usually people of color, African-Americans and others. So there's been a long-standing tension here, and I think the Floyd case seems to be the straw that broke the camel's back, not only in terms of police reform, in terms of true, genuine improvement in relations between the police departments and the communities they serve. And as an aside, the police chief in Minneapolis, who I know, Chief Medari Arredondo, whose nickname is Rondo, he's a progressive-minded police chief, 28-year veteran of the force, who last week got on the witness stand and basically, crucified Chauvin during direct and even on cross-examination. There were 9 Minneapolis police officers who took the stand and said what happened to Floyd is something that they don't teach.
Right.
Something that was out of the norm.
I think that's been one of the most astounding aspects of this trial. We've never seen that level of police supervisors.
Yeah, and the police here, the two departments, St. Paul and Minneapolis, have in recent years, I would give them some credit for trying to do more in terms of community policing, diversifying its police force. But what you have is you have that police chief administration mission statement, and then you get the rank-and-file cops, many of whom go out and get trained on what's called, guerrilla warfare police training instead of police guardian training.
Ruben, what is the rough breakdown in terms of the racial makeup of the Minneapolis and St. Paul police departments, if you know, roughly?
I don't know the exact numbers, but I would say probably it's a 70-30 split in both Minneapolis and St. Paul. 70% white and the rest 30%. Minority.
And that roughly matches the minority percent of the population, does it?
Yeah, pretty much. It does.
So let me just tell people that this is we're talking to Ruben Rosario, an award-winning columnist now retired from his position with the Pioneer Press in St. Paul, who's been covering the streets and the courts and the crime in that city and the Twin Cities area. And the show is Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins. We're here on WBAI 99.5. Ruben, in your terrific collection of columns, which I love the name, Deadline Minneapolis, you talk about the officer who actually first informed you about the George Floyd death and I think shared the video with you before it had even really surfaced. You want to tell us about that exchange? And
well, his name is Tony Spencer, was a 20-year resident of the St. Paul Police Department, and it was the same summer where Philando Castile was shot. There was a man by the name of Frank Baker, a resident of the housing project on the east side of St. Paul. And long story short, he was mistaken. He was sitting in behind the wheel of his Jeep in the parking lot of this building outside his own building. At the time, there were cops searching for what had been turned out to be erroneous reports of an armed suspect in the area. Long story short, they mistake Mr. Baker for possibly the armed suspect. They order him out of the car. Apparently, he was a little slow in getting out of the car. A canine cop was let loose by biting the guy's leg. Another cop comes and apparently either thinks that Baker is still armed or there's something underneath his body while he lay prone, getting bit by this dog, and violently kicks him several times in the chest area. Mr. Baker suffered seven broken ribs, both collapsed lungs, and several nasty bites on his leg. Tony Spencer and his partner were among the cops who showed up to the scene. They were not involved in the apprehension or the encounter with Mr. Baker, but they were both senior cops, and they felt so disgusted by that incident that actually one of them went to accompany Mr. Baker to the hospital, and the other stayed behind and wrote a detailed complaint to the supervisor then. Long story short, Mr. Baker, of course, was never charged. He was never the suspect. Mr. Baker won a $3.3 million lawsuit against the city of St. Paul. The police chief terminated the officer, the K-9, and the one who did the kicking. But there was a civil service hearing because the cop who did the kicking, who was fired, he opposed his termination, took his civil service, he got his job back.
Is that by arbitration, Ruben? How did that happen exactly?
Yeah, by arbitration. Yeah.
I see.
This cop, Tony Spencer, went to the hearing and testified against these cops. And a few months after that, he turned in his badge. Meanwhile, at the same time, saying that the majority of the cops on his force tried to do the right thing, but he just couldn't stomach what he had seen and watched. And so I tracked down Tony and ended up doing a column about this situation. And I think it was the next day that the city settled with Mr. Baker because Spencer pretty much told me what had gone down. Hmm. And Spencer then left the force. He's now has a cushy corporate job somewhere and probably enjoying it. But it was Spencer, the morning of the 26th, I get a ping on my cell phone, and it's Tony. He goes, have you seen the video? I said, what video? He sends me the video that we've all seen of what happened to Floyd, and there were no words. And he was saying, you know, this is disgusting. You know, if you can't treat people with human kindness, you shouldn't be on the force. And thankfully, there are cops like that. There are cops who are now blowing the whistle. There are cops who are slowly, hopefully, now tearing that little blue wall of silence that has kept many from pointing fingers at their own. But in the Floyd case, they don't need to point fingers. We've all seen what happened that night.
Well, I was going to ask you whether or not Tony Spencer was atypical, or if there were, you think that the most widespread reaction among other officers in the Twin Cities area was the same kind of disgust to what they saw on that video, or were they sort of, you think, sort of open to being persuaded that their fellow brother in blue might have had the need to keep his knee on the fellow's neck for 9+ minutes?
I know quite a number of cops on both sides of the rivers here in the Twin Cities. I have not heard any of them say or defend this cop. They all said this is disgusting, or this is outlandish, or this guy should get fired, or this guy should go to prison. I have not heard one cop try to defend this guy. Now, is there still a brotherhood out there? Of course. And, you know, is there a great need of police reform? Genuine, long-lasting, long-term? No question about it. No question about it. Actually, Spencer was the one that told me, you know, we train to shoot every year or whatever. We should also undergo psychiatric examinations. I mean, he was pretty serious about that. Because cops undergo stress, or, you know, the cop that you recruited out of the police academy and sworn in and all that may not be the top 5 years down the road in terms of mental state or mindset or well-being. And so that might be a possibility in terms of adding that to the police reform toolbox.
After the after Floyd was killed, the city endured several nights of, I guess, often violent clashes, arson on a police precinct. Do you have a sense of what it was that tipped those protests over into violence and other kinds of mayhem? What was going on in the streets those nights? Do you know?
There were angry protests, but mostly peaceful. And then you got some outside agitators that would come in. I don't know if they planned this or organized this, but there were quite a few people outside the state, outside the metro area, who came in to do harm. There were several arrests here, and a lot of times the people here that were, you know, found through videos or through other evidence of arson and committing other wanton acts of destruction were not from the area.
And some of those people were from not the usual political perspective, right? There were some people from the right as well.
Correct. They were. And, you know, in terms, it was a powder keg waiting to happen. I wasn't surprised that it led to civil unrest because, as I mentioned before, we've had in this area a series of fatal police-involved shootings or deaths in custody dating back every year since 2015, and the only law enforcement person who was held accountable in a court of law happened to be in the Justin DeMunn case, and that officer happened to be an officer of Somalian descent. So out of all those incidents, the only cop that actually was locked up was a black guy. So that had been building for a while. And when the Floyd video came out, that was the fuse.
Well, let me just ask you briefly about the incident with this Australian woman who died so terribly. I mean, she was certainly, you know, did absolutely nothing to invite it. Presumably, the reaction to charge the officer then was the proper response, do you think?
He just shot. He didn't know who was out there outside the squad car. He just panicked, and he was in the passenger seat. His partner was in the driver's seat. He fires across from his partner at this shadowy figure at night who approached the squad car. But no, you know, there was no justification for it.
So I'm just curious, you've been reporting on police for you know, more than four decades now, Ruben. So we've got these examples of, you know, a cop the other night, a woman who tries to pull her taser, allegedly, and instead pulls her gun. You've got another cop you're talking about now who for some reason was prompted to pull his gun on a defenseless woman. Like, what do you think is going on in those situations? Is it a panic?
It's panic. I don't know what's going on. Maybe inadequate training. It's a host of things. I think perhaps the crop of police officers coming up now may not be as, I don't know. It could be the law, the Supreme Court, that gives cops the benefit of the doubt in using deadly force if they fear, reasonably fear in their own mind, not whatever hell is going outside, but if they fear in their own mind that either their life or the lives of somebody else might be in danger. And so if they see, you know, if they fear that shadowy object, that person, you know, 10 feet away is holding his gun rather than a cell phone, under the law, if they do fire and they do fear and there's evidence and testimony that he or she felt that their life was in danger, most often than not, they're going to be acquitted. That's one aspect. The other one is there's a lot of freaking guns out there. Mm-hmm. Across America. There's far more guns now than there are people. And if you know, since the pandemic, there's been a record number of people buying guns, first time gun owners.
Is that people also true in the Twin Cities area as well, in terms of the...
Oh, no question about it. There has been ammunition and firearms that have been out of stock for months. I go to some gun sites and see if I can buy a Glock. It's all out of stock. I go and see if I can buy 9mm ammunition. They're all out. Who's buying this stuff? Well, people are afraid. The pandemic caused a little bit of it, but even before, there's a lot of guns out there. I think cops are aware of that.
What is the mood in the city right now? What's your sense of it?
It's tense. Well, it depends where you live. If you live in Brooklyn Center, the mood is pretty tight and tense. Minneapolis, the same way. In St. Paul, probably not that much, although there's a curfew that has been announced for the Twin Cities tonight, beginning at 7 p.m., ending at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. So they're preparing for the worst if the worst comes and there's more civil unrest. I kind of doubt it, but who knows? You know, some people weren't prepared on May 26th either. And then we had 3 or 4 days of pretty violent uprisings and riots and acts of arson. So, you know, the cities are a little bit on edge. They are. It's getting to the point where, like, you know, what's next?
And there are, I know that there were National Guard that were detailed in Minneapolis, and I believe some of them went up to Brooklyn Center overnight.
You're correct. Yeah, they go up, and they're going to be up there for a while throughout the curfew tonight. And also St. Paul has called on extra cops to patrol tonight, just in case. Because the riots back in May following the Floyd killing not only took place in Minneapolis, they spilled over in St. Paul, causing millions of dollars in damages to a commercial strip in the St. Paul area.
Let me... just ask you briefly in terms of the status of the trial. The defense is about to present its case to the jury?
Yeah, I believe probably towards the end of this week, if not the middle of it. I believe the state is wrapping up. They had George Floyd's younger brother testifying today in what's described as the spark of life testimony, and that's when you are able to introduce witnesses to speak to the character and the life of the person who died. And so his brother was there on the stand, not for long, 10, 15 minutes. I don't believe the defense even asked them the question. And before that, this morning, there was a use of force expert from South Carolina, I believe, just another law enforcement agent doubling down with the other 9 police officers who have taken the stand and have said pretty much that this is outside the norm of policing.
Do we have any sense of the case that the defense will present? Do we think Officer Chauvin will take the stand at this point?
Well, I believe, you know, the defense is defending the indefensible. I mean, they don't have much to work on. So what a defense attorney, good defense attorney does is try to draw everything on the bulletin board to see if anything sticks. So, for example, you know, describing the teenager who took the video that went viral, a 9-year-old girl, and the father of two who turned out to be that martial arts guy as being a hostile or angry crowd that may have delayed the officer or distracted the officer from getting off Floyd's neck. You think it sounds preposterous, but there it is. And then, but the centerpiece is trying to convince the jury that Mr. Floyd died of a heart attack and the fentanyl and methamphetamine that was in his system, and not from the 9 minutes and 29 seconds where his neck was being compressed by Officer Chauvin's knee. So that's pretty much what he has to work with. He's going to bring in his own use of force experts, his own medical experts, and I think he's a dead duck, definitely on the manslaughter and third-degree murder, which constitute like a depraved indifference to human life kind of charge. It's the second-degree murder, the one that's going to send him for a longer prison term. I think the defense attorney is fighting to get the jury to acquit on that.
Does it help his case to put Chauvin on the witness stand to try to humanize himself in this terrible situation he's in?
Well, the problem is that, from what I heard, Chauvin doesn't have the kind of personality that makes it pretty risky to put him on the stand. I think that he has something to lose. He has everything to lose if he doesn't take the witness stand. He has to take the witness stand. The case the state has presented to me so far has been overwhelming.
Right.
I think the only shot he has is to get on that witness stand and try to explain to the jury why he did what he did to Mr. Floyd.
All right, we're going to take a brief musical break. We're talking to Ruben Rosario, the esteemed columnist and longtime newspaper man from the Twin Cities of Minnesota, former columnist for the Pioneer Press. And Reggie, if we've got it queued up, I too late to get that Ruben Blades cut we wanted, but how about Mi Gente, my people, by Hector Lavoe for a little bit.
Cuidado que por ahí vienen los anormales. Y con Estrella que profundo. Lo llamé, no me preguntaron dónde, orgullo tengo de ustedes, mi gente siempre responde. Vinieron todos para oírme guarachar, pero como soy ustedes, yo lo invitaré a cantar.
The estimable Reggie Johnson, our great engineer, corrects me. I'm sorry, Hector Lavoe. Ruben, let's talk a bit about your long career in newspapers. You were born in San Juan. You were raised in New York City, and you had a kind of old-fashioned introduction to the news business. You became a copy boy at the Daily News. Was that part of your goal, to become a reporter?
Well, it was. I graduated from Fordham University with a degree in communications. And I figured, hey, I got it made. I got this paper that says I'm a graduate. And I'm going to go and get a job as a reporter and become a star and become another Tom Robbins. Well, real life is that New York is it, man. It's competition time. And the only job I could get traveled as a copy boy at the Daily News, the only newspaper I ever wanted to work for. And so back in 1976, I got that opportunity and spent about 3.5 years working as a copy boy, fetching sandwiches for reporters, hobnobbing and learning everything I could from the likes of P. Hamill and Jimmy Breslin, who I consider two of my biggest mentors or influence in my career. And then finally the news gave me the shot to be a reporter at the Brooklyn Bureau, where I started. And then Ron Howell, another former newsie, and I opened up the newspaper's first bureau above 96th Street, over 125th Street, the Harlem Bureau. And we worked to kind of get stories up there and Upper Manhattan and the Bronx for about a year and a half.
You mentioned in your collection of columns that while you were working as a copy boy, you delivered a letter that was addressed to Jimmy Breslin in some peculiar handwriting. Well, tell us that story briefly, would you?
It was 1977. Working as a copy boy, not only you fresh sandwiches and coffee and liquor and other stuff for reporters, but you also sort the mail. And so one day I got this envelope in Jimmy Breslin's name, and there was bizarre scribblings outside this envelope. And I looked at it and I said, wow, that's weird. Put it in his mailbox, and a couple hours later, I got, like, cops in the newsroom, you know, running around, and I'm going, like, what the hell happened? So I found out from Jimmy later that was the letter that the infamous Son of Sam, the first one, the infamous Son of Sam, had sent to Jimmy Breslin. We all know Son of Sam was the crazed gunman who shot to death a whole number of teenagers and seriously wounded some others during that summer, hellacious summer of 77. And, it was surreal.
That's a bit of true tabloid history there. Ruben Rosario delivers the letter that Son of Sam was giving to Jimmy Breslin to basically brag about these terrible deeds that he was carrying out on the streets of New York. Once you became a reporter, you tackled some of the toughest stories that anybody could ask for. Whose idea was it for you to go into a crack den and just find out what was going on there?
Well, I think it was by default. Arthur Brown was the city editor, metro editor at the time. I think Gil Spencer was the top dog in the newsroom, and they came up. You know, at that time, you know, the crack cocaine epidemic had really hit New York City hard, particularly in the distressed communities. And there was a thought of, you know, let's send somebody. Let's have somebody do like a first-person account of what it's like on the streets. And my understanding was that a lot of the reporters, or some of the boys they approached, kind of declined the assignment because they felt it might be a little too risky. And me, well, you know, I grew up on the streets and I know New York, and I said, why not? So we were a former drug dealer, and I went up to Harlem. And finally, after I was kicked out of four crack dens because they thought I was a narc, the fifth one, people were so zonked out that they couldn't care less. And we were charged $1 for a rental crack pipe, for another $1 to enter the place. We went in there after we had bought a rock of crack from a prostituted woman on one of the street corners. And then, you know, we formed a circle of people passing the crack pipe around. And I had pretended that my buddy here, the former drug dealer, was a friend of mine. And it was his birthday. I was going to give him a knife in the eye. And then the crack pipe came up to me, and there you go. Was there a dilemma for me? You know, I technically was breaking the law, right? Well, I took a whiff of it because everybody had said, you know, you take one whiff of it and you become a crazy killer and all this and that. I just felt lightheaded. And as we're leaving the crack den, a police car is passing by, uniform. My buddy goes, oh, don't worry about them. I said, why? He said, because a few of them got locked up for robbing drug dealers. And now uniformed cops are prohibited from making drug arrests up here in Harlem. So it was a one night of a adventurous night that opened up my eyes and opened up hopefully a lot of readers' eyes to the effects this emerging crack cocaine was having on the city.
That's a remarkable story. And, you know, you say there's nothing to worry about. You knew the streets. But still, that's the kind of stuff that I think makes a true reporter, someone who's willing to wade into the situation to be able to. And that was such a remarkable story. Into the Den of Lost Souls? What was the title that they used?
Journey into the Den of Lost Souls.
Journey into the Den of Lost Souls. And you did have that journey. All right. You know, you spent most of your career in St. Paul, but I want to just mention to listeners that, you know, some of my strongest memories of you and I at the Daily News were not when we were working, but that when the two of us were out on strike against the owner, the Tribune Corporation, for 5 months in the winter of 1991. Yeah. And there's a great photograph that ran in the New York Times of Ruben Rosario on the picket line on Christmas Day, saying, "I felt like somebody needed to be here." quite a commitment.
Yeah. I don't think people understood how momentous that strike was. I don't think people really understood how momentous that strike was. It lasted 5 months. The strikers formed their own newspaper. We were the first newspaper in New York City to send a reporter to cover the Persian Gulf. He got that before the Times, Newsday, anybody else.
That's right. Charlie sent it.
We had Cardinal O'Connor and Mayor Koch vowing to not talk to scab reporters.
We definitely sent the bullies packing back to Chicago when they tried to put us in.
We did, although we lost one third of the workforce too.
We did. So, you know, you're a raised New Yorker, not quite born here, but you end up deciding to go to St. Paul. Just tell us briefly how that happened.
Well, towards the end of the strike, the National Association of Hispanic Journalists just happened to have their annual convention in New York. It was in June of 1991, I'm sorry. And I had already decided I was in mid-career at the Daily News. We lost one third of the workforce. I wanted to take a shot at being an editor. Thereby, I knew, you know, now the competition was going to be really fierce because, you know, whoever was editor there is going to stay editor there. There was going to be not too much room for movement. So I had the NASJ scheduled three newspaper interviews with me. One was Seattle Times, the other one was USA Today, and the last one for the day was St. Paul. And as you and I well know, Tom, New York is at the center of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Anything, you know, west of the Hudson River, we really don't care about. And anyway, I mistook St. Paul for St. Petersburg. I thought to myself, Florida, I'll give it a shot. I sit down. I wasn't going to go. I sit down. I look at the recruiter. Her name was Midge Kinning, managing editor of the Pioneer Press. I didn't even know what the paper's name was. And I sat down, and then I noticed then that there was a banner above her head. And it said, St. Paul Pioneer Press, Minnesota's first newspaper. And I'm like, Minnesota? I felt like getting up, but I wanted to be respectful. So she asked me, they were looking for a city editor, and they asked me, well, what do you know about Minnesota? I said, well, the Vikings play there, right?
The Vikings, yeah. Right.
And remember, Mindy Kiernan was from Florida, which further added to my confusion. She had a heavy southern accent. Then I go, well, what do you know about Minnesota? And I go, it's freaking cold. And she started to laugh. And you know, I took a look, and she told me about the paper that had won two Pulitzer Prizes 2 years in a row, one in 1986 and one in 1988, for a tremendous series called AIDS in the Heartland, about two farmers dealing with AIDS. They were owned by Knight Ritter. They had an investigative team, and the writers were unbelievable. They were a really good writing style of the paper. And I said, well, after they wine and dine me and got me to accept the job, I said, I'll give it 2 or 3 years, and then I'll go back home. Well, I didn't realize 2 or 3 years in the New York real estate market is a long time.
Yes.
So the nice little cushy apartment I had at Penn South in Chelsea, 2-bedroom, where I was paying $600 a month, Well, I realized that the people outside of the Penn South were paying like $1,000, $2,000 a month. So, but in any case, I ended up loving the paper. I ended up loving the Twin Cities area. We have a Puerto Rican restaurant. We got 16,000 to 20,000 transplanted Puerto Ricans here, mostly New Yorkers and from Chicago. So I feel a little at home still, and we can get pretty much anything that you can get in New York.
Okay. That's Ruben Rosario, transplanted New Yorker now in St. Paul and happily there, former reporter for the Daily News, where he and I worked together, and retired now from the St. Paul Pioneer Press, where he won just an avalanche of awards for his columns and his work over the years. The show is Deadline NYC. We're on WBAI 99.5 FM. You kind of hit the ground running once you got to St. Paul, didn't you?
Well, I was city editor for about 5 years and pretty much supervising General Simon and the police reports. And it was a team restructuring where they sectioned off different teams. So I became the public safety team leader. And then I started thinking, you know, I had my fill of being an editor and dealing with multiple headaches. And I had this longing to be, you know, go back to writing. And I proposed to the news editor, I said, look, why don't we do this? You know, people here, some of the columns here are pretty good, but they write about their cabins up north and flower gardens and all that. There's a lot of serious stuff going on in the underbelly of the Twin Cities that's not being addressed in the columnist form. Give me 6 months. Let me write a column dealing with tackling these subjects. And if you don't like that 6 months, then I'll go back to editing or I'll go to the investigative team. Well, that 6 months turned out to be 23 years until last year when I decided to hang up my hat.
You know, if folks want to get a sense of what real kind of in the streets, as well as kind of heart-on-the-sleeve journalism sounds like, Ruben Rosario's collection, Deadline Minnesota, is an awfully good way to get a sense of that. You know, it's a dying breed, Ruben. There aren't a whole lot. I mean, you know, Breslin's gone. Nobody really replaced him, not just in talent, but actually just in doing the kind of column that you were doing in St. Paul, which was, well, you tell me, how would you describe what you thought your job was day to day? What did you think you needed to do?
Well, what I need to do is kind of find the story behind the story of either breaking news or news trends or news issues, particularly in the field of criminal justice, social justice, immigration issues, because even though we're nowhere near the Mexican border, we still have a sizable population of the undocumented population here that, you know, have gone through quite a bit. And sustaining the shadow economy in many small towns in the state that's not appreciated. And so I wanted to write about that. I wanted to write about people who fall right below the public radar screen, ordinary people, call them heroes, call them whatever, who are doing the extraordinary, you know. And so those are people, or, you know, issues like child abuse, that they come in the one, not in one-dimensional as monsters, as, you know, parents who beat up their kids, but in three-dimensional, and see how society is trying to do its best to protect these children, but also to help unify families that can be unified. And so I shadowed child protection investigators for a week. That opened my eyes that there are parents there just at their wit's end. Their parents are trying to do the best they can. But those kinds of stories, not flower gardens and not cabins up north and not, you know, the 10 best restaurants in St. Paul. There are other people, I'm not knocking people who are right about that. People are very skilled at that, but that's not my cup of tea. My cup of tea was what Breslin and Hamill showed before me, was to go out there and write about these kinds of people and report your columns.
And you did something else too, Ruben. I mean, you got people to talk to you, which is sometimes not the easiest thing to do. Did you find that they wanted to talk to you?
I don't know if they wanted to talk, but it's how you approach people. I always say, if I was ever a professor at some college, I say, you know, writing well and comprehension is great, and you're going to need it. The thing that you'll need that they don't teach is people skills. Either you have it or you don't. And if you don't, try your best to get it. Because if you can walk into a room and sit down with the vice president of the United States, for example, or a former vice president, and get that person to talk, and then the next day go up to Stillwater Prison in Minnesota and talk to a convicted murderer and show that person some sense of respect so they open up to you, then you got the proper people skills to become a good journalist.
Well, that's a talent, you know, and as someone who does teach students who want to become reporters, I actually find that one of the challenges is to get people over what seems to be sort of a fear of going up and talking to people you don't know and getting them to talk. But you brought your, I don't know, I'd call it a New York sensibility to the streets of St. Paul and the people of the Twin Cities and got an awful lot of people to tell you. Is there one story just in the last 2 or 3 minutes that we have left in this show, Ruben, that you felt really sort of rang the bell or at least defined what you had tried to do as a columnist?
Wow. Well, the Floyd one, which is the last column in the book, you know, pretty much the end of that column, well, the column was about if you don't see, if you can't sympathize or empathize or see that that man lying prone on the street, a knee on his neck, calling out for his mama, if you can't see yourself in that, in George Floyd, if you can't see your brother, your sister, your mother, your daughter, if you can't see that person in yourself, then we're going to continue to have a problem with police-community relations. Until we see each other, until we are able to humanize in ourselves and put ourselves in other people's shoes, in a real sense, kind of fake lip service, in a real sense. That George Floyd, when I saw that video, and I heard him crying out for his mom, it touched me. That's me lying there. Or that's my son lying there. And we need to find a way to prevent these things from happening, whether it's serious police reform or it's a change of heart, societal change of heart. I'm a realist. That's a tall order. But I still find hope that we can do it.
You quote, I think it's in that column, one of your police sources, it might have been Tony Spencer, the fellow we were talking about earlier, talking about how you're trained to treat people as though you would want your own family to be treated. Is that roughly what his instruction was?
That's exactly what Spencer texted me that day. Exactly right. And I think, you know, I think that's what it's going to take. It's going to take training. It's going to take less warrior training, more police guardian training, more diversification in the police force. But, you know, that's never a guarantee. The officer who fatally shot 20-year-old Dante Wright was a female, mm-hmm. Okay? You know, this is not gender-specific, although I have to admit, ask me how many female officers have fatally shot people. Not too many. I actually think more female officers is better for the community. I think they have a certain way, not trying to be generalizing or stereotype, but I think they have a better sense of how to deal with such a situation. It's not that macho thing in the way.
It's not that macho thing, you know, except, of course, there's always an exception, and we saw a tragic one over the weekend. Look, I want to thank you, Ruben, so much for taking the time. We've been talking to Ruben Rosario, one of the really great old school columnists who hung up his pen a few months ago after a great career at the St. Paul Pioneer Press, and who also labored here in New York at the Daily News for many years. I recommend to folks pick up that book, Deadline Minneapolis, for a flavor and a taste of what real journalism can be like. Ruben, you take care, all right?
Thank you, Tom, so much. It's a privilege, and take care of my hometown.
We'll do our best. And in the meantime, we'll let Eddie Lockjaw Davis just steal the last few moments of this show. Stolen moments. Thank you, Reggie Johnson, for guiding us as always.
This is Hannah from WBAI's premiums department. As you may know, WBAI now has a new phone number to call to make donations or to pledge for premiums at 212-209-2950. Thank you for being a WBAI member and for making a contribution to keep the station afloat. But if you have a question about a premium, please do not call that number. All the call center can do is take down the info and send it to premiums@wbai.org, and time on the line costs us money. Instead, please email us directly with your question or concern. The email is premiums@wbai.org or call 212-209-2870. We promise to get back to you within a week's time. Again, please call 212-209-2870 if you have a question about a premium you ordered, or email premiums@wbai.org.
Joy of resistance. We're sisters of the...
President Biden's American Rescue Plan is being hailed as a giant step forward for women. But is it really? They say God is in the details. Join the Joy of Resistance on Monday, April 12th, 9 to 10 p.m. as we look at some of those details. We'll speak with Julie Cashin, Director of Women's Economic Justice at the Century Foundation, about the child care benefit and what the Biden plan does and does not offer. And we'll welcome back Wendy Murphy, the great activist lawyer who recently sued the Biden administration to force it to publish the Equal Rights Amendment. And she'll explain the relationship between the ERA and equal pay for women. We'll also present the feminist news and a tribute to the great Egyptian feminist Nawal al-Saadawi, who passed last week. That's Joy of Resistance, April 12th, 9 to 10 p.m. at WBAI New York.
WBAI's local station board, the Pacifica Foundation board, responsible for advising local management and operations, is holding a meeting on Wednesday, April 14th at 7 p.m. It's a remote access meeting accessible to the public, including an opportunity for public comment. The LSB meeting is Wednesday, April 14th at 7 p.m. The fastest and easiest way to join the meeting is by using the link on the Pacifica calendar and on the WBAI website. You can also access the meeting by calling 929-205-6099, 929-205-6099, and enter this meeting ID, 922-457-2995, 922-457-2995. And if that wasn't enough numbers, we also have a password. The password is 995, like WBAI's frequency, 995. So it's 995-995-99. Again, the phone number to call is 929-205-6099. The meeting ID is 922-457-2995. And the password is easy to remember because it's 995-995-99. Instructions for signing on to the meeting, including a link for listening over the web, is available through WBAI's main webpage, WBAI.org. Thanks for listening to all these numbers, and we hope you join us at the LSB meeting, April 14th at 7 p.m.